At the king's side in Sheen, trying to reassure the young man, trying to counter anything that his uncle the cardinal says, swearing that the young king is beloved, beloved of everyone, vowing on his life that he has never seen a horoscope for the king. His interest in alchemy is merely in the king's service. The herb bed at Penshurst was already planted, under the sign of the stars when they got there. He does not know who planted it, perhaps the former owner. I sit with the ladies in the Duchess's rooms and sew shirts for the poor, and say nothing. Not even when the Duchess suddenly laughs at random, and declares that she doesn't know why the King delays so long at Sheen Palace. Surely he should come to London, and then we could all go on progress to the country and get out of this heat. I believe he is coming tonight, I volunteer. She glances out of the window. He should have come earlier, she says. Now he'll be caught in the rain. There's going to be such a storm. A scud of sudden rain makes the women cry out. The sky is black as a crow over London, and there is a rumble of thunder. The window rattles in the rising wind, and then it is flung open by a gust of icy wind. Someone screams as the frame bangs, and I rise up and go to the window, catch the flying latch, and draw it shut. I flinch back from the crack of lightning over the city. A storm is rumbling in, over the king's route, and within moments there is the rattle of hail against the window, like someone flinging pebbles, and a woman turns her pale face to the Duchess and cries, "A storm over the king! You said that there would be a storm over the king!" The Duchess is hardly listening. She's watching me fighting with the wind at the window, and then the words, the accusation, sinks into her awareness, and she looks at the woman, Elizabeth Flight, and says, "Oh, don't be so ridiculous. I was looking at the sky. Anyone could see that there was going to be a storm." Elizabeth gets up from her stool, dips a curtsy, and says,
"Excuse me, my lady."
"Where are you going?"
"Excuse me, my lady."
"You can't leave without permission," the Duchess says harshly. But the woman has tipped over her stool in her hurry to get to the door. Two other women rise too, uncertain whether to run or stay. "Sit down! Sit down!" the Duchess shrieks. "I order it!" Elizabeth tears open the door and flings herself out of the room, while the other women sink to their stools, and one quickly crosses herself. A flash of lightning suddenly makes the scene look bleak and cold. Eleanor the Duchess turns to me, her face haggard and white. "For God's sake! I just looked at the sky and saw that there was going to be a storm. There's no need for all this. I just saw the rain coming. That's all."
"I know," I say. "I know that's all."
Within half an hour, the palace is barring its doors and windows and calling it a witch's wind that blows death down with rain. Within a day, the young king has announced that his aunt, the Duchess, may not come into his presence. The Oxford scholar, a friend of my first husband who came to visit us at Penshurst, is questioned by the council and confesses to heresy and magic. They put him on show, like a bear to be baited. Poor Roger Bolingbroke, a scholar for all his life, a man of learning with a great love for the mysteries of the world and the stars, is put on a stage, like a scaffold, at St. Paul's Cross in London, while a sermon is preached against him and against all witches and warlocks, necromancers and heretics, who threaten the king's life and his peace, who crowd into his festering city, who seek to enter his ports, who hide themselves in the country villages and do acts of malice, small and great. It is declared that there are thousands of evil men and women conjuring with black arts to harm the king, herbalists, wise women, liars, heretics, murderers. The king knows they are up there, plotting against him, in their malevolent thousands. Now he believes he has found a plot at the heart of his court, at the heart of his dangerously ambitious family. We all parade around Bolingbroke, circling him and staring at his shame, as if he were an animal brought back from the coast of Africa, some new sort of beast. He keeps his eyes down so that he cannot see the avid faces and need not recognize his former friends. The man who had spent his life in study, thinking about the harmonious nature of the world, sits on a painted chair, wearing a paper crown, surrounded by his equipments and his books, as if he were a fool. They have his geomancy board laid on the ground before his feet, and a set of candles specially carved. They have some charts showing the positions of the planets, and the horoscope that they say he drew up for the Duchess at her request. They have a little model of the Earth, and the planets moving around it. They have brass moulds for casting figures, a still for making liquids, and the wax trays used for drawing the perfume of flowers. Worst of all, at his feet is a horrible little creature of wax, like a miscarried rabbit. I shrink back when I see it, and Richard puts a strong arm around my waist. "Don't look at it," he advises me. I look away. What was it?
It was a wax image of the king. It's supposed to have a little crown on its head, and that golden thread is the scepter, and the little bead is the orb.
The face is distorted. The feet are formless. I can see the outline of the cape and the dots to show the markings of ermine, but the head is almost melted away. What have they done to it?
They heated it before a fire, so that it would melt and run away. It would make the king's strength flow from him, too. They meant to destroy him, as the image melted away.
I shudder. Can't we go now?
No, he says. We have to be here to show our revulsion at these crimes.
I am revolted. I am so revolted I want to go.
Keep your head up. Keep walking. You, of all people, have to be seen to be an enemy of this sort of work.
Me, of all people? I fire up. This is so disgusting, it makes me sick.
They are saying that the Duchess Eleanor got her husband the Duke to marry her with a love potion so that he couldn't resist her. They are saying you did the same when you were a girl and my Lord Duke was a man broken-hearted at the loss of his wife, Anne.
I shudder, averting my eyes from the melted wax poppet. Richard.
I shall keep you safe, he swears. You are my lady and my love. I shall keep you safe, Jacquetta. You will never look for me and find me gone.
We come back from the shaming of Bolingbroke to find the Duchess's rooms empty, the doors thrown open to her privy chamber, her clothes chests overturned, her cupboards ransacked, her jewellery boxes missing, and the woman vanished. "Where is the Duchess?" my husband demands of her maid-in-waiting. She shakes her head. She is crying unstoppably.
"Gone."
"Gone where?"
"Gone,"
is all she can say.
"God save us, the child is an idiot," Richard snaps. "You ask her."
I take her by the shoulders. "Ellie, tell me, did they arrest Her Grace?" She dips a curtsy.
"She ran, Your Grace. She's run into sanctuary. She says they will kill her to punish her husband. She says they will destroy him through her. She says it is a wicked plot against him that is going to be the ruin of her. She says Cardinal Beaufort will tear them both down."
I turn to my husband.
"Sanctuary?" His face is grim. "Yes, but she's mistaken. That won't save her." They can't say she's a witch if she's hiding on holy ground and claiming the safety of the church.
Then they'll accuse her of being a heretic, he says. A heretic can't be protected by the church. So if she's claimed sanctuary, they'll charge her with heresy. It's the only way to get her out. Before this, they might have charged her with forecasting. Now they'll accuse her of heresy. And heresy is a worse crime than forecasting. She's put herself in a worse place. The law of men always puts women in a bad place. I flare up in anger. Richard says nothing. Should we go away? I ask him very quietly. Can we go home to Grafton? I look around the wreckage of the room. I don't feel safe here. Can we go? He grimaces. We can't go now. It looks like guilt if we go. Just as she looks if she admits guilt by hiding in sanctuary. I think we're better off staying here. At least we can get a ship to Flanders from here if we need to.
I can't leave the children.
He pays no attention.
I wish to God your father was still alive. You could have gone on a visit to him.
He squeezes my hand. You stay here. I shall go and see William de la Pole, the Earl of Suffolk. He'll tell me what's going on in the council.
And what shall I do?
Wait here, he says grimly. Open these rooms and treat them like your own. Behave as if nothing were wrong. You are the first lady of the kingdom now, the only royal duchess left. Order the ladies to tidy the place up and then have them sew with you. Get someone to read from the Bible. Go to chapel this evening. Parade your innocence.
But I am innocent, I say.
His face is dark. I don't doubt that she will say the same.
She does not say the same. They bring Roger Bolingbroke before her with the horoscope that she commanded he cast for her, with the magical instruments that were the tools of his trade as an explorer of the unknown realms, with the misshapen wax that they say is a melted image of the king, and she confesses to witchcraft and offences against the church. She admits that she has long used witchcraft with the Witch of Eye. And then they tell her that the Witch of Eye has been under arrest since the night of the Witch's Wind.
Who is the Witch of Eye? I ask Richard, in a hushed whisper, late at night with the curtains of the bed drawn around us.
Marjorie Jodemain, he says, his brow knitted with worry. Some practicing witch who was taken up for her crimes once before now. Comes from the village of Eye. She's known to the church as a witch. Known to everyone as a witch.
I gasp in horror. He looks at me.
For the love of God, tell me that you don't know her.
Not as a witch.
He closes his eyes briefly in horror. What do you know of her?
I never did anything with her but study the use of herbs, as my lord commanded. I swear to you, and I would swear to the court, I never did anything with her but study the use of herbs, and she did nothing at Penshurst but plan the herb garden with me, and tell me when the herbs should be cut, and when they should be sown. I didn't know she was a witch.
Did my lord command you to see her?
Yes, yes.
Do you have that? Under his seal, did he write the order?
I shake my head. He just sent her to me, and you saw her. That time in the stable yard when you came with the message from Luxembourg, and she was leaving with the wagon.
Richard clenches his hands into fists.
I can swear that my lord commanded that she serve you, but this isn't good. It's not good. But perhaps we can glide over this. Perhaps nobody will bring it up. If it was just making a herb bed, at least you never consulted her. You've never ordered her to attend you.
I glance away. He groans.
No. Oh, no. Tell me, Jaquetta.
I took a tincture to prevent a child.
You knew about that.
The herbs? That was her recipe? I nod. You told nobody?
No one but you.
Then nobody will know. Anything else she made for you?
Later, a drink to get a child. He checks as he realizes that this was the conception of our daughter, Elizabeth, the baby who forced him into marriage.
Good God, Jaquetta!
He throws back the covers and gets out of bed, pulls back the curtain, and strides to the fireside. It is the first time he's ever been angry with me. He thumps the post of the bed with his fist, as if he wishes he could fight the world. I sit up, gather the covers to my shoulders, and feel my heart hammer with dread at his rage.
I wanted a child, and I wanted you, I say unsteadily. I loved you, and I wanted us to be married. But I wouldn't have cast a spell for it. I used herbs, not witchcraft.
He rubs his head, making his hair stand on end, as if these distinctions are beyond him.
You made our child with a witch's potion. Our daughter, Elizabeth.
Herbs, I say steadily. Herbs from a herbalist. Why not?
He casts a furious look at me. Because I don't want a child brought to life by a handful of herbs from some old witch.
She's not some old witch. She's a good woman. And we have a beautiful child. You are as bad as this witch hunt with your fears. I took herbs to help me to be fertile. We made a beautiful child. Don't you ill-wish us now?
For God's sake, he raises his voice. I am afraid of nothing but you being mixed up with a most notorious witch in England, who has been trying to kill our king.
She is not, she would not, I shout back at him. She would not.
She is accused.
Not by me.
By the Lord Chief Justice. And if they look for her associates, they will find you, another royal duchess, another woman who dabbles in the unknown. Another woman who can call up a storm. Or capture a unicorn.
I am not, I am not.
I burst into tears.
You know I am not. You know I do nothing. Don't say such things, Richard. Don't you accuse me. You of all people.
He loses his anger at my tears and comes quickly across the room, sits beside me, and gathers me against his shoulder.
I don't accuse you, my love, I know. I know you would never do anything to harm anyone. Hush. I'm sorry. And you are not to blame.
I can't help it that I foresee.
I know you can't help it.
And you of all people know that my lord put me before the scrying mirror day after day, and all I could see was a battle in snow and a queen. A queen with horseshoes reversed. He said it was useless. He said I couldn't foresee for him. I failed him. I failed him.
I know. I know you don't conjure. Be still, my love.
I did take herbs to get Elizabeth, but that was all. I would never conjure a child. Never.
I know, my love. Be still. I am silent, and as I dry my eyes on the sheet, he asks me, Jaquetta, does anyone know of this recipe that she gave you but you and her? Did anyone see her with you at Penshurst? Any of the court know that she was there?
No. Just servants. And her boy.
Then we will have to pray that she keeps her mouth shut about you. Even if they take her to the stake.
The stake? I ask stupidly.
He nods in silence, and then gets back into bed beside me. Together we watch the fire burning down in the grate.
They will burn her for a witch, he says flatly. And the Duchess, too. Westminster Palace, London, October 1441. The Duchess and the witch come before the court, charged together with both witchcraft and treason. The Duchess claims that she only visited Mrs. Jourdemain for herbs for fertility, and the herbalist gave her a drink and said that it would make her conceive a child. I sit at the back of the room, behind the avid spectators, and know that I did exactly the same. Marjorie has been charged with witchcraft before, and so they ask her why she continued to practice her arts, the herbs, the incantations, the foreseeing. She looks at the Archbishop of Canterbury as if he might understand her. "If you have eyes, you can't help but see," she says. "The herbs grow for me. The veil sometimes parts for me. It is a gift. I thought it was given by God." He gestures at the wax doll that sits before him on the desk. "This is a most unholy curse, an attempted murder of an anointed king. How could it come from God?" "It was a poppet to make a child," she says wearily. "It was a little doll to make a beautiful and talented child, who would be an ornament to his country and a treasure to his family." Without thinking, my hand steals to my belly, where a new baby is being made, who I hope will be an ornament and a treasure. Mrs. Jourdemain looks at the Archbishop. "You are frightening yourselves with a poppet," she says rudely. "Do you great men have nothing better to do?" The Archbishop shakes his head. "Silence," he orders. They have all decided already that this was an image of the king, made for melting. They have all decided that she is a witch, a brand for the burning. Once more, I am watching the most powerful men in the kingdom bring their power to bear on a woman who has done nothing worse than live to the beat of her own heart, see with her own eyes. But this is not their tempo, nor their vision, and they cannot tolerate any other. They kill her for it. They take her to Smithfield, the meat market, where the innocent cattle of the counties around London walk in to be butchered. And like an obedient lamb, trustingly herded into the blood-stained pen, she goes speechless to the stake. They light the fire beneath her bare feet, and she dies in agony. Roger Bolingbroke, who confessed and recanted, finds no mercy either. They hang him on the public gallows, and as he is kicking in the air, whooping for breath, the executioner catches his feet and cuts the rope, restoring him to croaking life, lays him on a hurdle to revive him, but then slices open his belly, pulls out his entrails so that he can see his pulsing heart, his quivering stomach spilling out with his blood, and then they hack him into quarters, his legs from his spine, his arms from his chest, and they send his head with its horrified glare to be set on a spike on London Bridge, for the ravens to peck out his weeping eyes. Thomas Southwell, my one-time confessor, the canon of St. Stephen's Chapel, dies of sorrow in the Tower of London. Richard says that his friends smuggled poison to him, to spare him the agony that Bolingbroke endured. The Duchess's clerk, John Home, is sent to prison, awaiting pardon. And the proud Duchess is forced to do public penance. The woman who paraded into London in cloth of gold with the nobility of the kingdom in her train is stripped to her linen shift and sent out shoeless with a lighted taper to walk around Westminster as the people jeer and point at her as someone who was the first lady of the kingdom and is now humbled to dirt. I watch from the steps of the great gate of Westminster Palace as she walks by, her gaze fixed on the cold stones beneath her flinching bare feet. She doesn't look up to see me, or the women who once scrambled to serve her, but are now laughing and pointing. She doesn't raise her head, and her beautiful dark hair tumbles over her face like a veil to hide her shame. The most powerful men of the kingdom have dragged the Duchess down and sent her out to be a marvel to the common people of London. They are so deeply afraid of her that they took the risk to dishonour their own. They are so anxious to save themselves that they thought they should throw her aside. Her husband, who is now generally known as the good Duke Humphrey, declares that he was seduced into marriage by her witchcraft. The marriage is instantly declared void. She, a royal duchess, the wife of the heir to the throne, is now a convicted witch in her petticoat. No man will give her his name, and they will keep her in prison for the rest of her life. I think of the illusion that I saw as we came off the barge at Greenwich, that she was followed by a black dog. A fighting dog, a black mastiff, and the smell that lingered around her despite the perfume and the perfectly washed linen. And I think that the black dog will follow her, and will run up and down the stairs of Peel Castle on the Isle of Man, as she waits long, long years for her release into death. Grafton, Northamptonshire. Winter, 1441-1444. As soon as we can be excused from court, Richard and I go back home to Grafton. The terror of the court is only stoked by the death of the witch, the disgrace of the Duchess, and the mood of witch-taking. Apprehension of the unknown and fear of the hours of darkness infects all of London. Everyone who's been studying the stars for years, reading books or testing metal, finds a reason to leave for the country. And Richard thinks it is safer for us if I, with my perilous ancestry, am far away from court. At Grafton there is much work to do. The death of Richard's father means that Richard inherits the land and the responsibilities of being the lord of the small village and the keeper of the peas. I too have work to do. The cradle is polished again, and the swaddling bands laundered and aired. I think this will be another son, I say to my husband. I don't mind, he says. As long as the baby is well and strong, and you rise up from childbed as joyfully as you lie down in it. I shall rise up with a son, I say, certainly. And he will be an ornament to his country, and a treasure to his family. He smiles and taps me on the nose. You are a funny little thing. What do you mean? And we shall call him Anthony, I continue. For the saint? My husband asks. Why him? Oh, because he went to the river to preach, I say. I like the thought of honouring a saint who preached to the fishes, and they put their little heads out of the water to hear him. And the mermaid said, Amen. The next year, after Anthony, comes another girl, whom we name Mary, and after her, another girl. Jacquetta, my husband declares. She is to be named Jacquetta. The most beautiful name for the most beautiful woman. We are hanging over the little wooden cradle while the baby sleeps, her face turned on one side, her perfect eyelashes closed on her rosy cheek. Her eyelids flicker. She's dreaming. I wonder what a baby dreams. Do they know that they are to come to the parents that we are? Are they prepared for the world we are making? Richard slides his arm around my waist. And though we love her, we have to leave her for just a little while. Hmm? I am absorbed in the clenching of her tiny fist. We have to leave her for only a little while. Now he has my attention, I turned towards him in his grip.
How so?
We are to go to France with a great party to fetch home the king's bride.
It has been decided?
The marriage of Henry has been a long time coming. My own first husband, Lord John, was picking out French princesses for him when I was a new bride.
At last?
You've missed all the gossip while you were in confinement, but yes, it is decided at last, and she's a kinswoman to you.
Margaret, I guess at once. Margaret of Anjou.
He kisses me as a reward. Very clever. And since your sister is married to her uncle, you and I are to go and fetch her from France. At once I look towards my sleeping baby. I know you don't want to leave her, he says tenderly. But we will do our duty for Henry, fetch the bride, bring her home, and then we will come back here. I am summoned by the king to serve him. I have to go.
You're asking me to leave a nursery with 6 babies, I say. How can I go?
I know, he says gently. But you have to do your duty too. You are an English duchess and my wife, and the head of our house is asking you to fetch his bride. When they marry, it will bring peace to England and France, the one thing my lord wanted when he died.
We have to go, my love. You know that.
It is a service to the king and to him, your first husband and my good lord. It is a service to him too.
Nancy, France, Spring, 1445.
I am not the only unenthusiastic member of the marriage party. Our leader, William de la Pole, the Earl of Suffolk, is said to be so mistrustful of the French, and so unimpressed with the fortune that Margaret of Anjou brings, that before he left England to start the negotiations last year, he had the king swear that nobody should ever blame him for bringing the French princess to England. Cardinal Beaufort, who now rules everything, may see this as the way to lasting peace, but Duke Humphrey of Gloucester swears that the Valois king will just buy time with this marriage, and then come against our lands in France. I know my late husband would have feared above everything else that this is a new ruse by the French to make us hand over Anjou and Maine to René of Anjou, the new queen's father. Almost everyone left behind in England, while we spend a fortune on a progress to France, regards the deal that we are making as utterly uncertain to bring peace, costly to make, and most likely to be at our disadvantage. The bride is brought by her mother from Anjou, and they say that she too is far from enthusiastic for a marriage that will put her in the bed of the king who has been an enemy of France ever since she was a baby. You're to go and see her first, before everyone, my husband tells me. I'm standing by the window of the castle, looking down into the stable yard. The horses of the Anjou party, a sorry herd of hacks, are being brushed down and watered and led into their stables.
Me? Why me?
Her mother knows your mother. They think that you can be her friend. You made much the same journey that she faces, from a Luxembourg castle to the royalty of England. They want you to meet her ahead of the rest of us so that you can introduce her to her new court. I don't know that I'll be any help, I say, turning to follow him. You'll speak the same language, and that'll be something, he says. She's even younger than you were when the Duke married you. She's only 15. She'll need a friend at court.
He takes me to the double doors of the best apartment and steps to one side. The guards swing open the doors and bellow, "The Dowager Duchess of Bedford," as I go in. The first thing that strikes me is that she is tiny, like a pretty doll. Her hair is a real bronze, a red gold. She wears a gown of slate blue, and a headdress perched far back on her head to show her exquisitely pretty face and her perfectly pale complexion. Her gown is scattered with embroidered marguerites, the daisies that are her emblem. The pout of her mouth suggests a spoiled child. But as she hears my name, she turns quickly, and the brightness of her smile is endearing.
"Ah, Madame la Duchesse!" she exclaims in French, and runs forward and kisses me, as if we are old friends. "I am so glad you have come to see me."
I curtsy. "I am glad to meet you, Your Grace."
"And this is my mamma. I was so happy when they told me you would come with the Earl of Suffolk to fetch me, for I thought you would tell me how I am to behave and everything. For you were married to the Duke when you were only a little older than I am now. And 15 is very young to marry, is it not?"
I smile at this nervous ripple of talk. "Hush," her mother says. "The Duchess will think you are a chatterbox."
"It's just that there are so many English people come to see me, and I find it so hard to remember names. And their names are so hard to say."
I laugh. "I couldn't even say the name of my house at first," I said.
"It's a hard language to learn, but I'm sure you will learn it. And everyone speaks French,
and everyone is eager to meet you and to be your friend. We all want you to be happy." Her lower lip quivers, but she speaks bravely enough.
"Oh, I have started already, and I can say the Earl of Suffolk and Cardinal Bouffet."
"Bouffet?" I query.
"Is that not right?"
"Beaufort," I identify. "They say it Beaufort." She laughs and spreads out her hands.
"You see? You will teach me how to say these words, and you will teach me how the English ladies dress. Will I have to wear great boots all the time?"
"Boots, Your Grace?"
"For the mud?"
I laugh. "Ah, they've been teasing you. England does get very muddy, especially in the winter, but the weather's no worse than, say, Paris. I prefer London to Paris, and I'm very happy in England now." She slips her hand in mine.
"And you will stand by me and tell me everyone's name, won't you? And how to say everything?"
"I will, I promise her." And I feel the grip of her little hand tighten as she turns to her mother and says,
"You had better tell them they can come in. I had better meet them all now."
She is a delightful little princess, perfect in every detail, except that her father, though called a king, cannot conquer his many kingdoms, and never will. She has no dowry, and though she says she brings us the islands of Minorca and Mallorca, we all know she will inherit nothing. Everything she requires for the wedding and the journey has been paid for by the Treasury of England, and there is nothing left in the Treasury of England. She is exquisitely beautiful, but so are many girls of 15. She is dearly loved by the French court, the declared favourite of her uncle, the Valois King Charles VII, yet she is not a princess of the House of Valois, but only of Anjou. He is not offering one of his own daughters in marriage to the English, but only a niece. In short, most of the English who are sent to fetch her think that we have been cheated. In the peace treaty, in the dower, and in the little princess herself. This is not a good start to a marriage. She is to be married in the chapel of St. George in the palace at Tours, where the Earl of Suffolk will represent the king and stand beside her before the altar and take her little hand from her father and the French king. Her sister, Yolande, is to be married at the same time. I know she is nervous, but I'm surprised to be summoned to her rooms 2 hours before the wedding, and find myself shown alone into her bedroom. No other attendants are present. She is dressed in her wedding gown of white satin, embroidered with marguerite daisies of silver and gold thread, but her hair is still plaited, and she is barefoot.
"My mother says you have a gift," she says, speaking rapidly in French without any preamble. "She says all the ladies of your house have the gift of foresight."
I curtsy, but I am apprehensive. "They say so, Your Grace, but I take all my hopes and fears to my priest and to God. I don't believe it is given to mortal men to know the future, and certainly not to women." She makes a quick exclamation and jumps onto the bed, careless of the priceless gown.
"I want you to draw my cards for me. I want to know what the future holds."
She pats the bed beside her, inviting me to sit. I do not respond to the invitation. "Surely your mother did not suggest this."
"No, she knows nothing of it. It's quite my own idea. Come, sit beside me."
"I cannot," I say, not moving. "The Court of England doesn't like prophesying or casting horoscopes. They certainly won't like the cards."
"The Court of England will never know," she says. "It'll be just you and me."
I shake my head. "I dare not." She looks stubborn. "If I command it, you will have to. You are my lady in waiting. You have to do what I say." I hesitate. If William de la Pole, the Earl of Suffolk, hears that I have upset the princess, there will be serious trouble. "Of course, my only wish is to obey you, Your Grace. But what if you ask me to do something that your husband, our king, wouldn't like? You must see that puts me in a difficult position. What am I to do then?"
"Oh, then you must do as I ask," she says simply. "Because the king will never know. Nobody will ever know. But I will have my way in this. I can insist. I do insist."
I kneel and bow my head, privately cursing her for a spoiled child. "Your Grace, excuse me. I cannot." She pauses.
"All right, then I won't get married," she declares. "You can go out and tell them that you've refused to prepare me for my wedding, and so I will not marry. The wedding is off."
I look up, smiling, but she is perfectly serious.
"I mean it," she says. "You show me the cards, or I won't marry the king. I insist on seeing my future. I have to know that this is the right thing to do. I won't go ahead without seeing what the future holds for me."
"I don't have any cards," I say. With a smile, she lifts her pillow and puts a pack of beautifully coloured cards in my hand.
"Do it," she says simply. "It is my order."
I shuffle the pictures gently. I wonder what will happen if she draws a bad card. Is she such a stubborn fool as to call off the wedding? I run through the arcana in my mind and wonder if I can hide those that show bad prospects.
"What if the cards are not good?" I ask. "What happens then?"
She puts her hand on mine.
"The wedding will go ahead, and I will never tell anyone that you drew the cards for me," she promises. "But I will know in advance that I'm going into danger, and what sort of danger it is. I will know to be on my guard. I want to know what is ahead of me. If I'm going to die in childbirth within the year, I want to know. If my father and my husband are going to go to war against each other, I want to know. If the English lords who seem to agree on nothing are going to tear each other apart, I want to know."
"All right," I say. I can see no way of getting out of it. But I'm not doing a full spread. This at least cuts down the possibility of a series of pessimistic prophecies.
I will do just one card. You take the cards and shuffle them. Her little hands stretch around the thick cards. She interleaves them and then puts them down. And cut. She cuts them and then puts the deck together. I spread them out before her in a fan, their faces down, their beautifully painted backs gleaming on the woolen covers of the bed. Choose one, I say. One will tell you enough. Margaret's red-gold hair falls forward, and she leans across, her pretty face very grave, trailing her finger along the pack, and then takes a card and holds it, without looking at it, to her heart. Now what? I sweep the untouched cards into a pile, and then say to Margaret, "Show it." She puts it face up. It could have been an awful lot worse. It is the card Joan the Maid saw in my hands all those years ago, the Wheel of Fortune.
"La Rue de Fortune,"
she reads.
Is that good? Is that very good?
The card shows a wheel with two beasts balanced on either side of it, one climbing up, the other tumbling down as the wheel turns. The handle for the wheel is extended beyond the card, so one cannot see who is turning it. Perhaps it is spinning at random. Seated at the very top of the card is a funny little blue animal, crowned and holding a sword. My great aunt told me this little animal shows that it is possible to watch the wheel turn and feel neither pride nor regret. One can stand above it and see one's own life both rise and fall with the real indifference that comes from true greatness of spirit. One can look at one's own ambition as if it were all a mask of vanities, a dance for fools. It could not be a more unlikely card for Margaret. She is not at all a girl of indifference. It's good and bad, I say. It's a kind of warning that you can rise very high and fall very low. It says that fortune's wheel can take you, by no merit of your own, by no grace of yours, very high indeed. And then it can throw you down very low. "So how do I rise again?" she asks me, as if I'm some old hedgerow witch who tells fortunes for a groat. The whole point is that you cannot make your own fate. You are on fortune's wheel, just like this poor monkey animal in the smart livery who's going to fall down. He can't help himself. You can't help yourself. She makes a sulky little face. "That's not much of a foretelling," she says. "And anyway, doesn't the other animal rise up? This little cat thing. Maybe I am the cat thing, and I'm going to rise and rise." "Maybe," I say. "But then you go over the top of the wheel and are falling down again. You are supposed to learn to bear it, whichever happens, as if they were both the same." She looks blank. "But they're not the same. Victory and defeat are not the same. I only want victory." I think of Joan and the sign she made with her forefinger, the circle in the air, that meant that everything was dust. I make the sign to Margaret. "The Wheel of Fortune," I say. "It is your card. You drew it. You insisted on a reading, and this is the card that you got. It tells us that we all only want victory. We all want to triumph. But we all have to learn to endure what comes. We have to learn to treat misfortune and great fortune with indifference. That is wisdom." I look at her pretty, downcast face and see she has little interest in wisdom.
but perhaps you will be lucky.
Titchfield Abbey, Hampshire, summer, 1445.
At first, she is lucky. She meets the king, and they like each other on sight. Why would they not? He is a handsome boyish man of 23, still somehow fragile, with a delicacy inherited from his French mother. And she is a strong-willed beauty 8 years his junior. The Earl of Suffolk, William de la Pole, escorting her to a new country, and enchanted with her, predicts that they will make a good match. Her fire and passion will be softened by his sweetness. He will learn determination and courage from her. They are married at the Abbey at Titchfield in a service that reflects the young king's quiet seriousness. I suspect that Margaret would have preferred something more showy and more grand, but there is no money for a great wedding, and anyway the king said that the wedding should be between him, his bride, and God. Disastrously, his fool of a confessor, Bishop Ayscough, performs the wedding and warns the serious young king that he should not succumb to lust. He warns him that he should go to the bride's bed only for the purpose of getting heirs to the throne, and not for their pleasure. The boy, who has been cautiously raised by men anxious to protect his innocence, takes the advice like a novice monk, and stays away from her bed for a full week. Margaret is not a young woman to deal patiently with such a husband. She summons me to her room the morning after her wedding and drags me into a window bay.
"He doesn't like me," she whispers urgently. "He got up from my bed as soon as everyone had left the room and spent half the night in prayer. And then he crept in beside me like a mouse and slept all the night without so much as touching me. I am as much a maid as ever I was. The wedding was for nothing."
I take her hands. "It will happen," I say. "You must be patient."
"How is the marriage to be binding if it is not consummated?" she demands.
"It will be consummated. He will do the act, Your Grace, and we should be glad that he is not forceful."
"Is he even a man?"
she hisses scornfully, not glad at all. "He is a man. He is your husband. And he is your king," I say. "It will happen. He will do it within the week." "As long as it's not a saint's day or a holy day," I think to myself. "If he can confess straight after the deed. Not in the morning before Mass, never in daylight. He is indeed extremely pious. And, Your Grace, when he approaches you, you must accept him without comment, without complaint." She tosses her head.
"But I want to be loved. I've always been loved. I want my husband to love me with passion, like in a troubadour tale, like a knight."
"He does love you. He will love you. But he's not a lustful man." The anger goes from her as quickly as it came, and the face she turns to me is puzzled.
"Why would he not desire me on the first night? On our wedding night?"
I shrug. "Your Grace, he is a thoughtful young man, and very spiritual. He will come to you when he thinks the time is right, and then you must be kind to him."
"But who will be kind to me?" she asks, pitifully.
I smile and pat her cheek, as if she were my younger sister, and not my queen. "We will all be kind to you, I promise, and you will be happy."
London, summer 1445 to 1448. Margaret is lucky in that she is young and beautiful, and the Londoners take to her on sight and cheer her coronation. She is lucky in that she is endearing.
I'm not the only one who comes to love her and watch for her safety. Around her little court, she gathers a collection of people who adore her. Me she keeps close, her dearest friend and confidant. She loves Alice, William de la Pole's wife, too, and the three of us are inseparable in these early years of her marriage, except for when I go to Grafton for my confinements, a new baby, John, and one who comes early, and is especially small and precious on that account, Richard. But she makes some mistakes, and they are grave ones. Her liking for William de la Pole leads her to insist that he be consulted in the King's councils, and he, already a great man, rises to even higher importance through her favour. The two of them speak against the King's uncle, Duke Humphrey of Gloucester, and they whip up suspicion against him so powerfully that he's accused of trying for the throne on his own account, treason against his own nephew. The shock is too great for the Duke, and he dies before they can bring him to trial. At once there is a storm of gossip which declares that the good Duke was murdered, and people point the finger of blame at William de la Pole. After the loss of this, his last uncle, the King leans yet more on his other advisers and consults the opinion of his young wife. This is a terrible choice. She is little more than a girl. She knows nothing about England, and in truth she knows nothing about anything. The King's other favourite is Edmund Beaufort, the Duke of Somerset, and Margaret is dazzled by the dashing, penniless Duke who calls her cousin and kisses her on the mouth in greeting. He is the most handsome man at court, always beautifully dressed in velvet studded with jewels, always riding a big black horse, though they say he is not a penny in the world, and is sworn up and down from his handsome dark head to his best leather soles, to the moneylenders of London and Antwerp. He brings the Queen little gifts, fairings that he picks up in the market, and they delight her as he pins a little brooch to the hem of her dress, or offers her a piece of candied peel, popping it in her mouth, as if she were a child. He speaks to her in rapid, intimate French, and tucks a blossom behind her ear. He teases her as if she were a pretty maid and not a queen. He brings musicians in, and dancers. The court is always merry when Edmund Beaufort is in attendance, and the King and Queen command him to stay at court all the time. Perhaps it would have been better if they had not done so, but the handsome young Duke is ambitious, and he asks and gets the command of the English forces in Normandy, as if they were toy soldiers for his amusement. The young King and Queen can refuse him nothing. They load all their favourites with offices and money, and the court becomes a hen-house of strutting jealousy. We all do well out of this. They are prodigal with titles and posts. They give away their own lands, the places at court for free, the opportunities for trade and bribery, licences to import, licences to export. Crown lands, which are supposed to pay for the King's living throughout his reign, get thrust into greedy hands, in a helter-skelter of generosity. William de la Pole finds himself ennobled beyond his dreams, made into a duke, the first man without royal blood ever to take such a title. Edmund Beaufort gets a dukedom too. It is a hiring fair of honours. The King and Queen take it into their heads that Edmund Beaufort should be given a fortune to match his title. He should be given a fortune to match the famously wealthy Richard, Duke of York, a royal kinsman. No, better still, he should overmatch the great Duke of York, and the young King and Queen say they will give him whatever it takes to do so. Even Richard and I are swept along on this torrent of gifts. They give us a great London house. And then my husband comes to me and says, smiling, "Tell me, my darling, what name do you think I should have?" "Name?" I ask. "Oh, Richard, is the King to give you a title as well?" "I think it is more the favour of the Queen to you," he says. But at any rate, I am to be a baron.